But Mike, you wrote the best-selling classic Trend Following, which is what we're really excited to dig into, especially more of the fundamentals. And could you give us just a little background on, well, before we get into trend following specifically, how you initially got into trend following?
Good question. So really dates me a little bit, but going back in time to summer of 1994, I had gone to Florida State.
And that's where I went to school. Maybe that's the connection.
We didn't even know. I don't know if you knew. I got my MBA from Florida State and I wanted to work on Wall Street. I could only find one alumni that was on Wall Street. And this guy, his name was Jim Massey. He had just retired as the CEO of Salomon Brothers. Went up and met with him. It was a really interesting meeting and he got me an interview, but you know, it just wasn't going to work. At the exact same time, almost, I picked up a magazine and it was Wall Street's top 100 paid for the year. And on that list was this guy named Jerry Parker, small little paragraph. And on this top 100, I think George Soros was number one. You know, this was in the early 1990s. And there's around 35 was this guy, Jerry Parker. And it said he was in his late 30s and he had just made $35 million for the year. And he was living 90 minutes away from me in Virginia. And he did not use fundamentals. He was not Warren Buffett. There was no value. He was using a trend tracking system and he was trained by somebody else. You know, you ever have those light bulb moments where you're just like, okay, whatever I've been told, I don't have the econ degree. I don't know what Warren Buffett knows. I don't know any of that stuff. But this guy, Jerry Parker, that I don't know, I don't know anything about him, but he used something called a trend tracking system that he was taught. That's all I needed to know. And it was down the rabbit hole to figure out who he was, how he did it. And then it turned out that there was a lot of other people that were doing what he did too. For example, just to kind of give people a big picture perspective, the current owner of the Boston Red Sox, who was in Moneyball, made all of his money with this kind of trend tracking system to buy the Red Sox. So it's just kind of this great underground story that's the antithesis of Warren Buffett. It doesn't say there's anything wrong with Warren Buffett. It just says there's another way to approach it.
Very interesting. Where did your career or your quest progress from that point forward? Was it books or was it a mentor or where did you go from that point?
Early on, it was a matter of, okay, who can I meet? And I ended up meeting John Henry at that point in time. And I met some other very, very accomplished traders, people that have appeared on my podcast or in my books, guys like Ed Sakota, Bill Dunn. These are names, if you Google, they just amazing individuals. And I put up a website in the late 1990s. And that was the way, it was kind of like one of the first finance blogs. And that really started to get a lot of traction and it produced a lot of profits. And then at some point in time, I think maybe in the early 2000s, after the dot-com crash, which this style of trading that I'm talking about is called trend following, and trend following did very well, typically does very well in crashes. But after the dot-com crash, you know, people started to get wind of what I was up to, at least from a business perspective and what I was doing online. And, you know, people start to hate a little bit and say, you know, I got some critics out there. And I said to myself, you know what? Let's do a book. I'm talking about myself. There's no let's. It's just me. I'm going to do a book. And I got a random introduction to a publisher. And one thing led to another. And a first book came out in early 2004, first edition of Trend Following. And I still remember the publisher calling me up and saying, hey, Mike, this is really interesting. Do you know what's going on? I was like, what are you talking about, Jim? The book's not out yet. He goes, well, your book, and they were very skeptical that they were going to ever have anything. He goes, your book is currently 500 on Amazon. I said, well, that sounds good. You know, 500 of all books. Roll forward years forward, and that book, you know, sold over 100,000 copies. Pretty good for a kind of obscure trading book by a guy with no writing skills.
Well, man, I am still new to the term trend following. I think the first time that we heard the term trend following, we had Meb Faber on, who I know has been a guest on your podcast a few times, and he was talking about trend following. I didn't know enough about trend following during that episode to even actually ask intelligent questions. But I'm wondering if you could give us your definition for the layman out there on what trend following is and what specifically it pays attention to.
I think the first thing to do is to think about the mindset. So the mindset of a trend following trader is not unlike a guy like Ed Thorpe, you know, the guy that wrote Beat the Dealer, or a guy like Mike Aponte, who was the MIT blackjack team leader, who a guy that I had on my podcast. This style of thinking is all about odds, and you're trying to find it, you're trying to find a mathematical edge. So you really don't care where you make your money. You're just saying, you know, as a trend following trader, you start the year and you say, you know what? I'm going to track, I've narrowed my portfolio down. I'm going to track 50 markets. You name it. Could be from Tesla to gold to palladium to coffee. Runs the gamut. So you select this portfolio you're going to track. And you say to yourself, okay, I don't know what's going to happen this year. I have no earthly idea what's going to happen this year. But when markets start to move, either up or down, because you can trade long or short, right? So if markets start to move up, I want to take that position. I have no fundamental insight. I don't know what's going to happen. I can't predict what's going to happen. But if Tesla all of a sudden makes a new 200-day high, I'm buying Tesla. I don't know what's going to happen next, because it's not really a big deal that I don't know what's going to happen next, because I have a stop. So if I get into Tesla, boom, and I lose, let's say 2%, I get the hell out. You got to roll that process forward across a portfolio, across entry signals happening on many markets. And what happens is you end up with a trading approach where essentially you're going to have 35 to 40% of these entries become winners. Winners where the trade goes in your favor to it enough, the trend goes into your favor enough to where you can make some profit. You're typically going to have about 60% losers. If you crunch the math, and folks can do some quick Google searches to crunch it even more, you're essentially ending up with a positive mathematical expectation, kind of a, you know, you can bet on this. I mean, look, anybody that's involved in poker or sports gaming, VC, I mean, it's the same thing. Look, if you're a VC on Sand Hill Road, you're going to take, I mean, I just had Jason Calacanis on my show. You know, if you take 19 positions in some, you know, angel investment, I mean, 19 of them are probably going to go dead. You're hoping one of them becomes Uber to pay for all the losses in the other one. And so it's a very different way of thinking, whereas someone like Warren Buffett would go ahead and have this idea that I'm going to select some of these biggest names ever and ride them for decades, Gillette, Coke, etc. I mean, I've had very, very accomplished trend following traders say to me, you know what, Mike, from a survivorship issue standpoint, I've got thousands and thousands and thousands more trades that I can show versus Buffett. And his point being, not to take anything away from Buffett, not to try and cast doubt, but to say, you know, look, there's always a little bit of luck involved in everything in life. Hell, we're lucky to be alive. But this is the idea with trend following, is you're going to have this portfolio, you're going to have winners and losers, and you're going to try and ride the winners as far as you can, and you're hoping those winners can pay for the ones that don't win the losses.
So the winners you want to ride as far as you can, and the losers you seem to want to cut short and cut your losses relatively quick. And I think you used the percentage of 60%. You'll have typically 60% losers. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, just we're being very rough here. I mean, that's, yeah, it's something like that. You're not going to, I think there's going to be very few trend following traders that will say, oh yeah, you know, I've got 60% winners or something. Or not like, you know, if you turn on CNBC late night infomercial and you got some guy who's telling you he's got 95% winners. Well, if you think about it though, logically, if someone says you got 95% winners, well, what happens to the losers if they're enough to wipe you out? I tell you another name that people will relate to this style of thinking. It's right in Nassim Taleb's wheelhouse, because that's really how he has done so well as well. Not exactly trend following trading, using other instruments like options, but his whole thinking is, you know, let me have a lot of small losses buying these options. And then when the shit hits the fan, a few will take off and it'll pay for everything.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to compare different people's strategies and different asset classes. When we've done episodes in options or Forex, even card counting before, a lot of times the odds they want to be winning 60%. But then you can go, say, to startups, like you said before, where, you know, 85% of your investments are probably going to be losers, and you hope the winners ride it out. So it's interesting to hear trend following is somewhere kind of in that middle range, but you can have 60% losers and still do very, very well.
Yeah, and I'll add to it. You just mentioned Forex. Currencies would be something in the portfolio of a trend-following trader. What's so cool about a trend-following strategy, and this gets back to my start, my light bulb moment, I don't have to know a damn thing about currencies. I don't have to know any of the fundamentals. It's just a price stream. Because at the end of the year, or whatever time horizon you're measuring, do you really care where your money came from? I mean, that's the big point here. I mean, this shouldn't be an emotional attachment thing. It's like Michael Lewis's new book about Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. We really don't give a rat's ass about where the money comes from as long as we're profitable. Tomorrow, if you launched a widget business and it made you $100 million, you know, somebody might look down on it and say, oh, it's just a widget business, as you're sitting back laughing all the way to the bank. Who cares?
we did an episode on municipal bonds. And we were trying to dress up municipal bonds as much as we could. So we rented a limo and went around Bangkok and talked about municipal bonds. And the guy was just like, hey, I don't care how boring it is. You know what's sexy? Making money. And I'm making money off trading these CEF municipal bond funds.
Everyone stumbles into some type of an opportunity. I mean, I guess, you know, look, some things can be sexier than others. Runs the range of opportunities out there in this lifetime.
So Mike, you mentioned a couple of, I wouldn't say there's that much overlap in value investing and trend following. You had mentioned Buffett earlier, but it seems like trend following is a much, much more active approach than something like value investing, where you might be in investments for a very long time. And a lot of the work is actually built up into the research and preparing to get in those funds at the right time. Is trend following something that someone that is active that's doing this full time, would they be participating and making trades almost every single day?
It's going to depend, because ultimately we can't predict what markets are going to move. I mean, right now it's a very low volatility environment. From a trading perspective, you could be trading end of day bars, end of week bars. Imagine taking a trading signal once a week. Just imagine turning off the screens, turning off the news, and you can trade a globally diversified portfolio of, you name it, from currencies to bonds to stocks to metals to agriculturals. And you're not looking at anything during the week. You're on a desert island, literally, and you've just got a stream of numbers. Can you trade this stream of numbers? You're just trading numbers. You're trading numbers, and you're literally just playing a game. It's not day trading. This is not high frequency. You know, I sometimes have people that'll come to me and they say, hey, you know, can I apply this trend following methodology to, you know, 30-minute bars? And I'm just like, well, maybe you can, but I've not seen that. You know, it's funny how people think. People want to go that direction because I don't know if they instinctively feel it's safer, or I don't know what the rationale is, but I would avoid the day trading stuff. That just seems like there's a lot more better ways to go than that.
Right. What would be some other common misconceptions when people get into trend following for the first time and start wrapping their heads around it and how to profit from it?
They want to hear that there's a prediction that, you know, when you take the entry signal for Bitcoin, that it will go to this. The only way that anybody could have traded Bitcoin in the last year or two would be a trend following approach. Because if you're going to take Bitcoin from 500 to 5,000 to 3,000, and then when it gets to 3,000, what trading strategy will possibly, you know, take you from either 500 to 10,000? I mean, you just can't know. And I think that can't knowing part, human beings want to have certainty. They want the chaos to disappear. They don't want to be stupid, so to speak. But, you know, trend following traders are stupid to what's going to happen. And I think that's part of the brilliance of it, is being smart enough to admit, I don't know anything.
When are we talking about signals? I've heard the word signals come out a few times so far. I'm thinking back to when you first started getting into trend following, I guess back in the late 90s, there was less software, right? There's less mechanisms to look at this stuff. But now there's all the types of software that I'm sure could, I don't want to use the word predict, but signal, I suppose.
Well, signals, think about it from this standpoint, though, back to the 40%. If you take a signal, you don't know that it's going to go anywhere. So trend following is about buying highs and selling short lows, the opposite of value. So if a stock is making its new all-time high, you're buying. I mean, think about what that causes the average human being to think. Oh man, what the fuck? It's at all-time highs and now I'm buying? This doesn't feel right. Well, that's part of the problem right there. It's not about feelings. It's about what does the math look like when you crunch it. In terms of software, look, there's all different types of ways that one can track a trend following portfolio. But let's say you are just back to my 50 market portfolio. If you're tracking 50 markets, you could sit there with some loose leaf sheet of papers. If you're trading end of day or end of week bars, you're not looking at a huge amount of daily work in terms of the need for computing. Now, look, testing is one thing, you know, doing your homework in advance. Trend following strategies have been tested and tracked on computers back to the 70s. It's not new. I mean, shoot, some of the biggest hedge funds in the world that trade trend following strategies, not but a few years ago, were using Excel spreadsheets. That right there starts to say another aha moment. Like, hold on, you mean some of the best traders on the planet, people that have made billions of dollars, have been using Excel spreadsheets? But hold on, this website, it's got all these bells and whistles and all these things going on, and it's so cool. Okay, well, that's great, but it's not doing anything.
Right. The greens and the reds and everything flashing in your face.
I mean, you know, I guess flashing in your face can be good for some things, but maybe not for trading.
But not when it comes to stock trading.
Can we tie our emotional need to feel smart or right or whatever? Can we put that to the side? And can we just follow an approach? Can we follow a process? Can we follow a system and know that we're never going to make money in a straight line? There's going to be volatility. Hey, look, even Warren Buffett, and I slapped this quote late in my newest edition of Trend Following, as Buffett is fond of saying, if you can't afford to lose 50% in the markets, you can't afford to be in the markets. 99% of all investors today don't believe that, but that's Warren Buffett, one of the most successful investors ever, saying that. What's going to happen when the next 50% downturn hits? It's going to be quite the shit show.
I feel like there's so much like new millennial money in the market right now, especially in things like Bitcoin. My gosh.
It's not bad if they have an exit strategy.
I don't think they have an exit strategy. I mean, who's got an exit strategy for Bitcoin? Everyone's like trying to get rich off 3 weeks. And I mean, people have gotten really wealthy off this stuff in the last few years. Some people have.
Well, there's the operative word, some, right? Some people walked away from the dot-com bubble and made out like bandits. For example, like, you know, Mark Cuban, who owns the Mavericks, and Dan Schneider, who owns the Redskins. Both of those guys cashed out in their 30s. There was plenty of other guys that didn't have the timing, and perhaps that timing was just luck. They didn't cash out, and they don't own professional sports teams in 2017. It's a crazy world, huh?
Yeah. Well, I keep reading, and every time I look at my finance news, I got the little finance app on my iPhone, and whenever I look, there's always the same types of sentences or same types of headlines, and it'll read something like, Apple just breached its 200-day moving average in a bearish manner or in a bullish manner. But that, it seems like that headline, not necessarily Apple, but for some stock that I'm tracking, it's always a headline every single day. Is that considered trend following or technical trading, or is there a difference between the two?
Yeah, there's some mixing and mashing there. For example, if you were to, and this gets back to something you were asking about a second ago. So if you were to talk about a type of a trend following system, could be something like a moving average crossover. It could be a breakout that gets you in and gets you out, a highest high to get you in, some XYZ period, you know, 100, 200 days, a breakout that gets you out in the opposite direction. That's very different, though, than the headline you just mentioned. The headline you just mentioned is kind of like what I would think of as almost the bastardization of trend following. This is taking, you know, trend following is a form of technical analysis, but the technical analysis that you just talked about, which is what you would typically see on Yahoo Finance or CNBC, will be somebody that comes on and says, the moving average crossover has just happened. Now I am predicting and telling you that this will happen. Well, that's just bullshit. I mean, literally, everyone listening right now, if you can just drop that and realize that anybody that tells you they have a piece of technical analysis that predicts what will happen on one market in isolation is just full of shit, 100% full of shit, including some of the biggest media properties in the world that put this stuff out on a daily basis.
Right.
I don't know. Is cursing allowed on your podcast?
Of course. The more, okay, the better. We sometimes have to nudge people to let out a little bit of profanity. But I think you're like three or four in the bag right now. If we could get that up to a baker's dozen, it'd be great.
I was screaming in a podcast monologue the other day on my show. Something, I think I was basically telling the audience, I don't know who the audience is, maybe no one will listen anymore, but I think I was basically telling the audience, F you, about some issue. So I...
Why are they giving you bad feedback on something?
No, I was just, I was doing a kind of rhetorical debate with myself and was saying, if you take this position, F you. So that's
That sounds like a lot of fun. Well, if you ever need anyone to yell at, I'm happy to sit across from you and I can be a little bit of a puppet audience. Just trying to peel back the layers a little bit for the layman who's new to trend following. The kind of fundamental stock or company information matter when picking a trend following strategy? Like does the price to earnings ratio or the certain size of a company particularly play well when it comes to trend following?
No, the trigger for trend following is it's a price action based strategy. So it literally, you're agnostic to the fundamentals. I mean, you could go back and you could have a trend following system. You could backtest this and you could go back and say, how could I perform on Apple, Tesla, you know, the S&P or whatever, without knowing the name of the company or the whatever the market is? It doesn't add any value. It's interesting, it's fun, it's sexy, whatever, but it's not relevant to trend following. And that you talk about misconceptions, that's a tough one to wrap your arms around, really, for the first time. Hold on, Mike, but if I have this extra knowledge of Tesla, but doesn't that make the trend following system so much better? Well, I would say, well, then, okay, code that for me. Code that for me. Test that for me. Show me how your extra bit of fundamental something added to the trend following system, show me how that makes it better. At that moment in time, the whole conversation falls apart. Most people, when I confront them with that, if they want to stay firmly in the fundamentals, have some value, and I can add a trend following, usually they go into some form of cognitive dissonance at that point in time. Then usually they start calling me names. Then there's some kind of ad hominem attack. And then usually, you know, I have to block them when they get too crazy. So it usually goes down that path because there's such a belief for folks. Now, if you look at the investment world, if you look at the professionals and you look at the academic world, you're going to find both ways you can go. If both ways are defined as value and the other way being momentum or trend following, the academic community and the professional trading community look at both of those as viable options. Because what's so cool about them is they're not correlated typically. So you're always wanting, I think there was a line that I caught the other day, and actually I think it was Meb Faber. He was talking about something that Ray Dalio said on Tim Ferriss's show, and uncorrelated investments, that's what we all want. Because if you can, you know, get a little return in something that's moving at a different rate or change or period than the typical stock portfolio, that's great. You know, you get a little extra return, you reduce the risk. That's what we're all shooting for.
Yeah, I think Ray Dalio was saying the holy grail of investing is if you can get 15 non-correlated bets, which seems kind of like a lot of bets, actually. I would think with trend following, you could get a bunch of those going pretty quick.
Well, you're going to get one for sure. So, for example, if you have a trend following portfolio and you can look at historical track, that the other great thing about trend following, the reason that I had so much confidence in it and I was able to do some books on it was because there were so many publicly available track records. So I was able to look at track records that went back decades. So you could see the monthly performance on traders going back decades. And you could say, oh, okay, they all made money in October of 08. Oh, okay. They all made money in March of 1995. Okay. They all made money in October of 1987. That's really, really useful information. To cut it short, though, trend following as a strategy typically correlates to a passive index or a typical stock portfolio at zero. It's the best in terms of if one only has stocks in some form or another, and you're just kind of traditionally long, trend following is one of the best initial first diversifiers.
I heard Meb say one time that if you look back through history, that we know value investing has always outperformed the market and trend following as well. I was like, that's a huge statement. That was the first time I ever really got my head around how powerful trend following can be.
Yeah, there's some great resources out there. People can find them on my websites too, but a couple free white papers that one by AQR, Cliff Asness, a big heavyweight in the fund management world, probably managing over $100 billion in assets, kind of like Ray Dalio's size. He's put some great papers out showing trend following trading going back literally hundreds of years. People have gone back and done the back testing. And you might say, well, why does this work? Because human beings are batshit fucking crazy. And they make decisions based off who knows what, however they're feeling at that moment, whatever emotional, whatever's going on. I'm going to buy and sell now because I feel this or I feel that. You know, if you kind of extrapolate and play that out over an entire market, and if you think about generations are always, new generations are always coming in, and you also think about this being a zero-sum game, you know, where you're going to have winners and losers, and winners are taking from the losers, this is just life. It's the circle of life.
Well, who out there is trend following right now? Is it typically retail investors, or is it big institutions? Mixed bag, of course, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. So you're going to have, it's going to be a little bit of all of that. Some professional trend following traders would tell me now that institutional players will accept trend following as a strategy. I don't know. You know, my newest edition of trend following, I was looking at the total assets. You know, if you say whatever percentage of, you say here's the total pool of investable assets across the globe. I think my best guesstimate was trend following is like less than a quarter of 1% or something. It was just, there was nothing. So basically the whole world is still a passive index or in long only mutual fund stocks. And, you know, look, if we have another stretch like we did in 2008, 2009 or 2000, 2002, and those were periods where you saw typical long only portfolios drop over 50%. I mean, look, most people today don't really remember that the NASDAQ dropped 77% 2000 to 2002. I mean, the Nikkei dropped 77% and says stayed down over 50% for decades. So I think that's one thing people should think about too, is that, you know, things can look really rosy, and I'm not trying to be some kind of uber bear. Trend following happens to do very well when stocks get very bearish, but I think people should really think about what could happen in the future. Do you have a strategy that can adjust to what could happen?
So does that mean that because there's not so many people trend following per se, that there is even greater opportunity to be a trend follower or to be investing in trend following strategies?
I don't know that there's any limits right now. For example, I don't think there's any kind of like, okay, there's too many people doing this. If we take a step back, this doesn't help me as a trader. But if we take a step back and we look at the landscape of what's happened since March of 2009, there's been a lot of government intervention, a lot of things that none of us could have predicted or could even imagine would go on for almost a decade. With that as a backdrop, for me, I start to say, gosh, what could that look like if it stops working? All one has to do is pop into Taleb's Twitter feed for a you can get a feel for that, you know, and he's a little bit brighter than all of us.
So. All right. Meb Faber's got this ETF, GMOM, I think, and that's a trend following ETF, which again was one of the first times I wrapped my head around this stuff. I think you can buy that ETF openly. I think you can also get access to it through a Betterment account. Do you know how that fund would actually operate? Is that somewhat like an active trader managing that ETF, and they're facilitating all the trend following within in it in a number of different strategies or funds?
I don't want to speak for Meb, but I assume that this is, and I looked at this a little bit before, this particular instrument, it's a trend following strategy applied to a portfolio. I mean, if you really want to have fun with it, one could trend following trade the trend following ETF. I mean, yeah. Right, you know, you could do that too. But I think that type of ETF, and there's other products, are designed to allow you to get that non-diversifier from a trend following strategy. So you can buy these ETFs or mutual funds and add it to your traditional stock and bond portfolio and get the diversification element that I'm talking about. One thing that we've not mentioned on this conversation is rates of return. You can pretty much look at the last couple decades and see that a lot of institutional investors have wanted less and less return. Because, you know, risk and return, it's a double-edged coin. You don't get big returns without taking more risk. If you look back in time at some of the most successful trend-following traders, they used more leverage back in the day. I mean, there was a demand for higher returns, whereas today, you'll probably find a lot of institutional investors are scared of their shadow because of career risk. And they're like, saying, you know, hey, just take all the leverage out and just give us something very small. And so you start to also think about, hey, if everyone is searching for less and less risk and markets are less and less volatile, you can imagine from those kinds of periods, that's when the black swan swims in. It's fascinating times to look at this. And look, we just don't know what's going to happen. And I think if anyone could take from me today, it's the I don't know. And someone sent me a great clip the other day from Game of Thrones. I'm not a fan of Game of Thrones, but it was a clip. You know, chaos is a ladder. Chaos is not a pit. When you're in chaos, just climb the chaos, the wall of worry. Climb the chaos. Put yourself in the middle of chaos and you're at opportunity. Now, trying to be comfortable with that, well, hell, that's tough, man. That's tough. That's tough for the average person. Again, this would have been why Daniel Kahneman won the Nobel Prize, because he was able to point out all of these frailties in the human condition.
So I know you've studied trend following and back tested it through decades and decades. Like, how would you even go about putting a process together to back test this in all types of different markets?
Today in 2017, you would want an off-the-shelf piece of software, something like TradeStation, MetaStock. There's other products called WealthLab or Mechanica software. I'm sure many of the brokerage firms have some testing capability in their products. And that gets you going in the direction. I mean, if this is going to be a little bit of DIY and you're going to kind of dig in, you know, it's going to require a little bit of elbow grease. You know, you're going to have to kind of, okay, let me think about how I'm going to approach a multi-market portfolio. How am I going to select my risk? How much do I want my leverage to be? These things become important issues when you're trying to put together a trend following approach.
So if someone out there wanted to apply trend following to Tesla, is there unlimited ways that you could cope a strategy around that? Or is there, with a single stock, is it fairly straightforward on how to get started with something like that?
Great question, in the sense that one market alone trend following would not be trend following. Because if you get back to the mindset of, if we start year one with a tracking portfolio of 50 markets, we don't know that Tesla is going to trend that particular year. If Tesla doesn't move, if it doesn't show us a trend, we don't have any way to make money. If markets go sideways, we don't have a way to make money. We're going to lose money if markets go sideways. We're going to lose money if markets go up and down and chop in what I would call a whipsaw. Actually, not what I would call a whipsaw. What people that have given me great insights over the years would have told me would be called a whipsaw. In fact, everyone should definitely Google, believe it or not, one of the best trend following traders ever, super wise guy, one of my mentors, and I would say consider a friend, but Ed Sakota has something on YouTube called the Whipsaw Song. It's Ed, in a very his mercurial way, playing the banjo, singing a song, which essentially puts the trend following rules out there. And I have to tell you something fun about Ed. Several years ago, I was on a stage with him and another noteworthy trader named Larry Hite. And the audience was filled, about 200 people. It was mostly the most successful fund managers in the world. And Ed got up and sang the song live. And it was really just one of those moments where you're saying, gosh, you know, there's people in the audience that are just multiple billionaires sitting in the audience. And everyone just gets it, because sometimes this really is about Occam's razor. I mean, this is like, take the simplest path, take the simplest approach, apply repeatable rules, be consistent, be disciplined, put the ego in check. And then, just then, if you're lucky enough, you might end up with something over time that looks pretty damn good.
In bull markets, bear markets, has trend following historically performed better in either one of those?
Bear markets, trend following has done exceptionally well. Ben Stein, the actor economist, came out and said after the fall of 2008, he said that if you made money in October of 2008, you were doing something wrong. Like every trend following trader made money in October of 2008. But I mean, you know, just if you think about it, like, hold on, why is somebody telling me if you made money in October of 2008 means I was doing something wrong, when I can look at all these track records of all these people not affiliated with each other who all made double digit returns in October of 08. And then you start to say, well, God, does this guy who's on the tube really even know what the hell he's talking about? Well, the answer is most people on the tube don't know what the hell they're talking about. They're not there to tell you anything useful. They're there to get you to watch because they make advertising dollars off you watching.
Someone wants to get into trend following right now. I assume there's lots of different ways they could do it. They could do it. They could apply it themselves. They could invest in a fund like what would be some other ways that they could potentially get access to or invest in trend following?
For example, my newest edition of Trend Following, and this is not necessarily a plug, but it's the best place that I know to send people if you're looking for names. If you're looking for names of people that have funds or mutual funds or ETFs where you can do your homework, look at their track record and say, you know what? This particular trend following trader typically would have made 30% in October of 08. This trader, this style of trend following would have made 10% in October of 08. So you can start to make comparisons and say, how do I feel about the leverage choice of this particular trader? Do I want to always be shooting for the home run? Do I want to be in a position to where I could possibly make 100% a year, which is going to take more risk, which means also a steeper potential drawdown? And all I mean by drawdown is if you have $1,000 in investments and it goes to 500, that's a 50% drawdown. It doesn't mean you've necessarily lost it because of it could be open positions, but you have to decide that those types of things. You have to decide, or you have to look at, do I want to be with a broadly diversified portfolio that includes currencies, commodities, et cetera? Do I want to be in a stock only portfolio? I think also when you mentioned something about Tesla, when you're talking about one market only, trying to be a trend following trader on one market only, if you were only doing that and you were only tracking Tesla and you had all of your money on Tesla, then you're limited. You don't have, if Tesla doesn't do anything, if Tesla doesn't move, this is why even with Bitcoin, I mean, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to be a trend following trader on Bitcoin alone. But I would say to somebody, if they're in Bitcoin or a few other cryptocurrencies, modify your thinking at least and have a trend following thinking. It won't be a perfect trend following system, but modify your thinking to where you say, okay, when Bitcoin reaches an all-time high and it retraces off the all-time high 25%, I give up 25%, then I'm going to get out. You know, no questions asked. Well, when do I get back in? Well, when it gets back to the all-time high again. So you mean I'm going to lose that money? Then I have to wait? Well, can't I buy it on the dip? Yeah, the favorite, you know? No, you can't buy it on the dip. The dip isn't necessarily real unless you've gone ahead and tested and decided that buying the dip is a smart thing to do. But again, we're talking one market only. So I'm literally just giving some kind of modified trend following thinking to those people that might not be familiar with trend following, that might have a cryptocurrency investment and might be saying to themselves now, after this volatility, what the hell do I do now?
Well, I guess when I just think conceptually to trend following, and it's just on price action. You know, if I think of a typical stock, let's just go back to Tesla. If you're just paying attention to price action, or let's say the all-time high of the stock, I guess that would be a reflection both on a few things, but one would be kind of company fundamentals. The company should probably be doing pretty well if it's at all-time highs. And also a lot on human emotion.
The dot-com companies were vaporware.
Yeah.
I mean, right now, Bitcoin's vaporware, really. I mean, there's nothing backing it.
Yeah,
it's just
exactly.
Belief. Mm-hmm. So it could be either way. Mm-hmm. You could have fundamentals that back that massive move, or you might not. Now, typically, if you do the wash for years and years and years, there should be some alignment there. But what happens when there's no alignment between the fundamentals and the trend? What happens when there's no alignment between the fundamentals and the price action? That's happens all the time. That's why I think for me, I get that if somebody wants to put a significant portion of their assets into something like indexing and they don't want to think about it and they don't want to stress about it, Okay. But, you know, look, I mean, stuff happens. Stuff happens, and it just doesn't always go how you're going to imagine. So having, again, that non-diversifier mixed in makes a lot of sense.
I think that's really interesting, and one of the very compelling things to me about trend following as I'm starting to get my head further and further around it is that, it, I guess, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's not, you're not trying to figure it out. It's literally a trend. It doesn't matter if it's human emotion or because the company's outperforming. It's just a trend, and you're looking literally at one variable, right? Or kind of one component that is considered the signal. And then you make your strategy based off that.
And that's tough because we're all like, you know, we're all creatures of trivial matters and trivial pursuit. And we all kind of want to know why. Well, what happens if you can't know why? And I think if we're all honest with ourselves and we were to look at moves across markets over the last three decades, absolutely nothing was predictable. None of it was predictable. I mean, come on. No one knew Jeff Bezos was going to be Jeff Bezos today that he was 10 years ago. Nobody was predicting even 5 years ago that Jeff Bezos was going to be the richest man on the planet. Right? Were they? I don't recall that.
You notice how much these guys have redone their look, like Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, in the last 5 or 10 years. I mean, you look at a photo of them 10 years ago.
Bezos looks like he's on roids.
Yeah, I think they all are. They've all had a hair transplant or two. Look at Elon Musk; has got too much hair now. My gosh! I guess you're going to be a billionaire, you might as well look the part.
I'm not going to argue that part. I guess you know. You keep it short, though, it looks like. So you're just not fighting it. So that's smart.
Oh, it's the humidity. And as it gets thinner, it's just better to keep it short. Easier to wear a hat and go to the gym and stuff. Hide it a little bit. Well, Mike, give us an update on the book. And I mean, we've been talking about trend following. You wrote the book on it. I know you've had a few reiterations of it. It just came out on Audible, I think, in June 2017. So I highly recommend that to the listeners. But what can we expect from the book? And I know it's just loaded with research and some of the things that we've been talking about.
You know, one of the things I did way back in 2004 with the book for the first time was I had this idea, and I went to the pub when I got the publisher. He was going to, you know, gave me $15,000 to write this book. And I said, hey, I want to put just random quotes in the side margin. It's one of the things that I really love about the hardcover. You don't see it as much in the Kindle. It's hard on the Kindle. But the hardcover, you've got like the content. But then I've tried to put complimentary pieces of wisdom, and it could be, I mean, God, I've got quotes in there from Animal House. I mean, you know, whatever interests me, Miles Davis, I mean, things you would not expect to be connected to trend following, to get people into the mindset that all of this is just psychology. You know, the math and the trading is just a way to manifest human behavior. If you think about it, you know, people are just nuts. And so if people are nuts and people have money, so we know that's true. People are nuts and they have money. So when crazy people have money, which we're all crazy and we all have some money, then we go to the markets. Why should we expect crazy people with money to do smart things in the markets? Well, it doesn't happen that way. So how can you, Mr. Listener, how can you figure out a way to take advantage of all these people that want to throw their money at the market with no strategy? Again, it's zero sum. Can you think up a strategy? Can you devise an approach that will take the losses from people that don't know what they're doing? That seems like a good approach.
You know, I can remember my first time losing money in the market. I was sitting in my fraternity room at Florida State. I put in all of my money that I had saved at summer jobs, and I was graduating in early 2008. And right when the market started having big hiccups in 2007, I remember logging in. I had lost like $4,000 or something in a day or two. And I just totally flipped out. I was like breaking up with my girlfriend, lost that money, sold everything. Actually, selling everything wasn't the worst thing because it would have gotten a lot worse. But I think it just goes back to like this whole, it's so easy to invest now. And you have this whole millennial generation that's super high tech. Everyone's getting into Bitcoin. It's so easy to open a trading account, start trading. I just worry that a lot of them, because we're not taught. I don't know what you learned at Florida State. You got your MBA. I just got my undergrad. I didn't learn any of this at Florida State.
I didn't
learn anything at Florida State, period.
I like Florida State. We got to be careful here that we people don't think we're completely slamming on it. But these kinds of things you don't learn in college, period.
Yeah, exactly. No, I love Florida State. But yeah, you don't learn anything about finance in college. That really hurt me getting out of college. It was this long upswing. I had to learn, you know, and of course, when I was graduating, it was 2007, 2008. So it was a really difficult time to be graduating and learning about these things. But yeah, I do worry about a lot of the millennials out there. They're getting really into investing now and putting all their savings into investings, but haven't gone through a big drawdown yet. And that concerns me for their generation, because it's hard to get out of those situations. If you lose it, you get out at the wrong time. It's really hard to pick, you know, roll up your sleeves and get back at it.
Can I say something perverse? I'm not worried about it at all. I hope they give me their money. I hope they screw up. I hope they don't know what they're doing. I hope they panic at the wrong time. And I hope I make more money because of it. I mean, that's the way the world goes around. Look, here's another great way to think about it. You brought up fall 2008 again. Omaha Daddy himself. What did he do that was so brilliant in the fall of 2008? The fall of 2008, I mean, literally, we all thought the ATMs were going to stop working. But Buffett clearly knew the ATMs were not going to stop working. And what did he do? He just walked around and he picked up every damn company he could, pennies on the dollar. You know, he was the guy that had powder dry because he knew chaos was here. He knew what to do. He had a plan in advance. And look, he had some underperformance for the prior decade. You know, he didn't do as good during the dot-com bubble and all that kind of stuff, but he stuck with his approach. He didn't really care what other people had to say or what they, you know, what they do or whatever. And he just stuck with his thing. I hear you about being worried about people, but I think, you know, the reality is we should all think of ourselves as mercenaries in the markets. The idea is to not lose all of our capital. The best way to make money is not to lose all of our money. Hopefully put ourselves in a position to do really well as big trends come.
And win the game as well. And Buffett, he's sitting on twice as much cash as he was back in 2007, 2008, I believe. I heard that's a rumor. That's a pretty interesting piece of advice to consider, basically.
I think one thing, too, to think about Buffett, not taking anything away from him, but there's only one. I mean, there's only one. And I always thought that was something interesting about trend following. There wasn't only one. There was all of these different players. This guy, Salem Abraham, I met years ago, lives and works in Canadian Texas, the panhandle of Texas, nowhere near anything. David Harding in London. John Henry was in Southern California for a long time. He went to Boston. I mean, you know, there's no perfect whatever. And there's so many different people doing it, different personalities, different political persuasions. There's only one Buffett.
Would you call him what of Omaha?
Big Daddy Omaha. Big Daddy Omaha. Yeah. I mean, come on.
I loved his documentary. His documentary was fantastic. I had a lot more respect for him after watching that documentary. I thought it was great.
You know, but he also, even though he has this value approach, he's not just a buy and holder. I mean, he's a complicated hedge fund with insurance companies spinning off cash. You know, he knows what his bet size should be. I mean, this gets into things like, you know, when you talk about gambling and stuff, and you talk about the Kelly criteria, Fortune's Formula, a good book recommendation, by the way. People should check that out. That for sure gets into the headspace of trend following.
You're a content machine. How many podcasts have you done so far?
Close to 600.
600. And they are excellent. I mean, some of the guests are legendary. Got, of course, Tim Ferriss on there, James Altucher. You've had some of the best investors on there. You do quite a variety of successful people. Is there anything on there that you try to unearth on every single episode?
If someone has a book, I'll read it. If they don't have a book, I'll try and figure out who they are quickly and then maybe give myself a page of notes. Then turn on the call and go and see where it can go. Sometimes it's kind of like improv comedy. You can have all the questions, you can have the script, but sometimes it's more interesting if that person says something to go down that path, because you can tell they're really interested in it. But what's hard about that, and you know this, is that, okay, I have to be planning ahead mentally for the next few minutes, because you know, I've got to keep this whole thing going. So it becomes a real challenge. It makes, I'm sure you can appreciate this too, it makes people like me and you that do a podcast really appreciate the brilliance of someone like Howard Stern. I mean, the guy's just a phenomenal interviewer. And to really have that ability to have some direction of where you want to go, but then improv it off what somebody says, boom.
Sometimes when we get on some of the CEO types on the episode, they got to pass it through legal and they got to pass it through PR. And we end up having to do a bunch of post edits. I like to get scripts across to them first just to make sure they're happy with the content and comfortable. The improv always goes better. The more interactive, it's always better.
It's funny you say that, though, because, you know, it's, I would give a piece of advice, since you and I are both doing these shows, to people out there that want to go on shows. Don't do what Sam just said. I mean, if you're going to go on the damn show, don't do an infomercial. No one wants to listen to an infomercial. If you're not going to be a real person, just don't do it then. If your world is so, you know, precarious that you can't talk without the attorneys and PR being involved and they're worried about every word you're going to say and you don't trust the host, then just don't do it.